Chapter 17. Drifting away toward other lands, toward other seas, toward other men, the sun, all red in a cloudless sky, raked the yacht with a parting salvo of crimson rays that shattered themselves in two sparks of fire upon the crystal and silver of the dinner service, put a short flame into the blades of knives, and spread a rosy tint over the white of plates. A trail of purple, like a smear of blood on a blue shield, lay over the sea. On sitting down, Mr. Travers alluded in a vexed tone to the necessity of living on preserves, all the stock of fresh provisions for the passage to Batavia having been already consumed. It was distinctly unpleasant. "I don't travel for my pleasure, however," he added, "and the belief that the sacrifice of my time and comfort will be productive of some good to the world at large would make up for any amount of privations." Mrs. Travers and Delcasser seemed unable to shake off a strong aversion to talk, and the conversation, like an expiring breeze, kept on dying out repeatedly after each languid gust. The large silence of the horizon, the profound repose of all things visible, enveloping the bodies and penetrating the souls with their quieting influence, stilled thought as well as voice. For a long time no one spoke. Behind the taciturnity of the masters the servants hovered without noise. Suddenly, Mr. Travers, as if concluding a train of thought, muttered aloud, "I own with regret I did in a measure lose my temper, but then you will admit that the existence of such a man is a disgrace to civilization." This remark was not taken up, and he returned for a time to the nursing of his indignation, at the bottom of which, like a monster in a fog, crept a bizarre feeling of rancor. He waved away an offered dish. "This coast," he began again, "has been placed under the sole protection of Holland by the Treaty of 1820. The Treaty of 1820 creates special rights and obligations." Both his hearers felt vividly the urgent necessity to hear no more. Delcasser, uncomfortable on a camp stool, sat stiff and stared at the glass stopper of a carafe. Mrs. Travers turned a little sideways, and leaning on her elbow rested her head on the palm of her hand like one thinking about matters of profound import. Mr. Travers talked. He talked inflexibly, in a harsh blank voice, as if reading a proclamation. The other two, as if in a state of incomplete trance, had their ears assailed by fragments of official verbiage. An international understanding the duty to civilize failed to carry out compact canning. Delcasser became attentive for a moment. "Not that this attempt, almost amusing in its impudence, influences my opinion. I won't admit the possibility of any violence being offered to people of our position. It is the social aspect of such an incident I am desirous of criticizing." Here Delcasser lost himself again in the recollection of Mrs. Travers and Amada looking at each other, the beginning and the end, the flower and the leaf, the phrase and the cry. Mr. Travers' voice went on dogmatic and obstinate for a long time. The end came with a certain vehemence. "And if the inferior race must perish, it is a gain, a step toward the perfecting of society, which is the aim of progress." He ceased. The sparks of sunset in crystal and silver had gone out, and around the yacht the expanse of coast and shallows seemed to await, unmoved, the coming of utter darkness. The dinner was over a long time ago, and the patient stewards had been waiting stoical in the downpour of words like sentries under a shower. Mrs. Travers rose nervously, and going aft began to gaze at the coast. Behind her the sun, sunk already, seemed to force through the mass of waters the glow of an unextinguishable fire, and below her feet, on each side of the yacht, the lustrous sea, as if reflecting the color of her eyes, was tinged a somber violet hue. Delcasser came up to her with quiet footsteps, and for some time they leaned side by side over the rail in silence. Then he said, "How quiet it is." And she seemed to perceive that the quietness of that evening was more profound and more significant than ever before. Almost without knowing it, she murmured, "Tea's like a dream." Another long silence ensued. the tranquility of the universe at such an august ampleness that the sounds remained on the lips, as if checked by the fear of profanation. The sky was limpid like a diamond, and under the last gleams of sunset the night was spreading its veil over the earth. There was something precious and soothing in the beautifully serene end of that expiring day, of the day vibrating, glittering and ardent, undying now in infinite peace, without a stir, without a tremor, without a sigh in the certitude of resurrection. Then all at once the shadow deepened swiftly, the stars came out in a crowd, scattering a rain of pale sparks upon the blackness of the water, while the coast stretched low down, a dark belt without a gleam. Above it the top hamper of the brig loomed indistinct and high. Mrs. Travers spoke first. How unnaturally quiet. It is like a desert of land and water without a living soul. One man at least dwells in it, said Delcasser, lightly, and if he is to be believed there are other men, full of evil intentions. Do you think it is true? Mrs. Travers asked. Before answering, Delcasser tried to see the expression of her face, but the obscurity was too profound already. How can one see a dark truth on such a dark night? He said, evasively. But it is easy to believe in evil, here or anywhere else. She seemed to be lost in thought for a while. And that man himself? She asked. After some time Delcasser began to speak slowly. Are rough, uncommon, decidedly uncommon of his kind. Not at all what Don Martin thinks him to be. For the rest mysterious to me. He is your countryman after all, she seemed quite surprised by that view. Yes, she said, slowly. But you know, I cannot, what shall I say? Imagine him at all. He has nothing in common with the mankind I know. There is nothing to begin upon. How does such a man live? What are his thoughts? His actions? His affections? His conventions, suggested Delcasser. That would include everything. Mr. Travers appeared suddenly behind them with a glowing cigar in his teeth. He took it between his fingers to declare with persistent acrimony that no amount of counterly intimidation would prevent him from having his usual walk. There was about 300 yards to the southward of the yacht a sandbank nearly a mile long, gleaming a silvery white in the darkness, plummeted in the center with a thicket of dry bushes that rustled very loud in the slightest stir of the heavy night air. The day after the stranding they had landed on it, oh, stretch their legs a bit, as the sailing master defined it, and every evening since, as if exercising a privilege or performing a duty, the three paced there for an hour backward and forward lost in dusky immensity, threading at the edge of water the belt of damp sand, smooth, level, elastic to the touch like living flesh, and sweating a little under the pressure of their feet. This time Delcasser alone followed Mr. Travers. Mrs. Travers heard them get into the yacht's smallest boat, and the night watchman, tugging at a pair of sculls, pulled them off to the nearest point. Then the man returned. He came up the ladder and she heard him say to someone on deck, "Orders to go back in an hour." His footsteps died out forward, and a somnolent, unbreathing repose took possession of the stranded yacht. After a time this absolute silence which she almost could feel pressing upon her on all sides induced in Mrs. Travers a state of hallucination. She saw herself standing alone, at the end of time, on the brink of days. All was unmoving, as if the dawn would never come, the stars would never fade, the sun would never rise anymore. All was mute, still, dead as if the shadow of the outer darkness, the shadow of the uninterrupted, of the everlasting night that fills the universe, the shadow of the night so profound and so vast that the blazing suns lost in it are only like sparks, like pinpoints of fire, the restless shadow that like a suspicion of an evil truth darkens everything upon the earth on its passage, had enveloped her, had stood arrested, as if to remain with her forever. And there was such a finality in that illusion, such an accord with the trend of her thought that, when she murmured into the darkness a faint albeit she seemed to have spoken one of those sentences that resume and close a life. As a young girl, often reproved for her romantic ideas, she had dreams where the sincerity of a great passion appeared like the ideal fulfillment and the only truth of life. Entering the world, she discovered that ideal to be unattainable because the world is too prudent to be sincere. Then she hoped that she could find the truth of life and ambition, which she understood as a lifelong devotion to some unselfish ideal. Mr. Travers' name was on men's lips. He seemed capable of enthusiasm and of devotion. He impressed her imagination by his impenetrability. She married him, found him enthusiastically devoted to the nursing of his own career, and had nothing to hope for now. That her husband should be bewildered by the curious misunderstanding which had taken place, and also permanently grieved by her disloyalty to his respectable ideals, was only natural. He was, however, perfectly satisfied with her beauty, her brilliance, and her useful connections. She was admired, she was envied, she was surrounded by splendor and adulation. The days went on rapid, brilliant, uniform, without a glimpse of sincerity or true passion, without a single true emotion, not even that of a great sorrow. And swiftly and stealthily they had led her on and on, to this evening, to this coast, to this sea, to this moment of time, and to this spot on the earth's surface where she felt unerringly that the moving shadow of the unbroken night had stood still to remain with her forever. "So be it," she murmured, resigned and defiant, at the mute and smooth obscurity that hung before her eyes in a black curtain without a fold. And as if in answer to that whisper, a lantern was run up to the foreyard arm of the brig. She saw it ascend swinging for a short space, and suddenly remain motionless in the air, piercing the dense night between the two vessels by its glance of flame, that strong and steady seemed, from afar, to fall upon her alone. Her thoughts, like a fascinated moth, went fluttering toward that light, that man, that girl, who had known war, danger, seen death near, had obtained evidently the devotion of that man. The occurrences of the afternoon had been strange in themselves, but what struck her artistic sense was the vigor of their presentation. They outlined themselves before her memory with the clear simplicity of some immortal legend. They were mysterious, but she felt certain they were absolutely true. They embodied artless and masterful feelings, such, no doubt, as had swayed mankind in the simplicity of its youth. She envied, for a moment, the lot of that humble and obscure sister. Nothing stood between that girl and the truth of her sensations. She could be sincerely courageous, and tender and passionate and well ferocious. Why not ferocious? She could know the truth of terror and of affection, absolutely, without artificial trammels, without the pain of restraint. Thinking of what such life could be, Mrs. Travers felt invaded by that inexplicable exaltation which the consciousness of their physical capacity so often gives to intellectual beings. She glowed with a sudden persuasion that she also could be equal to such an existence, and her heart was dilated with a momentary longing to know the naked truth of things, the naked truth of life and passion buried under the growth of centuries. She glowed, and, suddenly, she quivered with the shock of coming to herself, as if she had fallen down from a star. There was a sound of rippling water, and a shapeless mass glided out of the dark void she confronted. A voice below her feet said, "I made out your shape on the sky." A cry of surprise expired on her lips, and she could only peer downward. Lingered, alone in the brig's dinghy, with another stroke, sent the lifeboat nearly under the yacht's counter, laid its sculls in, and rose from the thwart. His head and shoulders loomed up alongside, and he had the appearance of standing upon the sea. Involuntarily, Mrs. Travers made a movement of retreat. "Stop," he said, anxiously, "don't speak loud. No one must know. Where do your people think themselves, I wonder? In a dock at home?" "And you, my husband is not on board," she interrupted, hurriedly. "I know." She bent a little more over the rail. "Then you are having us watched." "Why?" "Somebody must watch. Your people keep such a good lookout, don't they?
Yes.
Ever since dark, one of my boats has been dodging astern here, in the deep water. I swore to myself I would never see one of you, never speak to one of you here, that I would be dumb, blind, deaf. And here I am. Mrs. Travers' alarm and mistrust were replaced by an immense curiosity, burning, yet quiet too, as if before the inevitable work of destiny. She looked downward at Lingard. His head was bared, and, with one hand upon the ship's side, he seemed to be thinking deeply. Because you had something more to tell us, Mrs. Travers suggested, gently.
Yes, he said in a low tone, and without moving in the least.
Will you come on board and wait? She asked.
Who?
I. He lifted his head so quickly as to startle her. I have nothing to say to him, and I'll never put my foot on board this craft. I've been told to go. That's enough. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.